This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
The Trade Disability Power is such a powerful organization. And one of the things that Dessa and a number of her colleagues say often is when we design spaces, places, systems, et cetera, with disabled people in mind, then we end up actually creating solutions, spaces, and places that actually work ideally for everyone.
Welcome to the third episode of the Building Reuse is Climate Action Limited Series, sponsored by Quinn Evans. I'm Nikita Reed, an architect and preservationist who specializes in sustainable design. Many of you know me as the host of the Tangible Remnants podcast, where I demystify the adaptive reuse process for building owners and developers. Beyond the podcast, I'm also an associate principal at Quinn Evans, where I help to bring adaptive reuse projects to life. This limited series will highlight one successful adaptive reuse project per episode and will feature people involved on the project from both the design side and the client side. This series is going to pull back the curtain and do a deep dive into each project to discuss how a project went from conception to completion, the lessons learned along the way, and how the building is positively impacting the community today. By the end of each episode, you'll have a better insight into some of the unforeseen conditions that come up on adaptive reuse projects and the types of decisions that can impact your project. It's all part of my goal of demystifying the adaptive reuse process for building owners and developers. Today's episode is all about the Love Building in Detroit. From the owner side, I'm joined by Kwaku Ose, current executive director of the Love Building, and Jeanette Lee, founder and former director of the Love Building. From the Quinn Evans design team, I'm joined by Sandra Little, principal and director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, who served as the lead architect on the project. The Love Building is located in the core city neighborhood of Detroit and is home to 7 nonprofits, each contributing to a shared mission of liberation and joy. These nonprofits include Allied Media Projects, the Detroit Justice Center, Detroit Disability Power, the Detroit Community Technology Project, Detroit Narrative Agency, and Paradise Natural Foods. Through intentional design and community engagement, the Love Building has become a model for accessibility and collaboration. In this conversation, we explore the power of adaptive reuse, the importance of community benefits agreements, and the role of radical philanthropy in making transformative projects possible. If you've ever wondered how a building can become a beacon of inclusivity and empowerment, then this episode is for you. Before we jump into the conversation, though, let me give you some history on the building. The structure known as the Love Building was originally constructed in the early 20th century and served as a furniture showroom and warehouse. Towards the end of the 20th century, it transitioned into being used as artist studios and spent more than 20 years serving that use. During that time, serving as artist studios, a mural was painted on the building depicting silhouettes of four hands spelling out L-O-V-E in American Sign Language. That mural, which gives the building its name, was painted on its Grand River Avenue facade. The Love Building's redevelopment was spearheaded by Allied Media Projects and provides office space for several nonprofit organizations dedicated to improving Detroit. Quinn Evans, in collaboration with California design partner Designing Justice and Designing Spaces, also known as DJDS, led the design efforts. In addition to office spaces for nonprofits, the building's ground floor includes a multi-purpose community room, which supports a wide range of events. Be sure to check the show notes for visuals of the project, facility rental information, and other adaptive reuse resources. And while you're in the show notes, go ahead and sign up for the Tangible Remnants newsletter to get adaptive reuse tips right to your inbox. You'll hear more about Quinn Evans later in the episode, but for now, let's jump into the conversation. Without further ado, please enjoy this conversation about the Love Building in Detroit, featuring Kwaku Ose, Jeanette Lee, and Sandra Little. I'm really excited to have you all on the show today. I would love to jump right in. And Jeanette, I'd love to hear from you about what was your involvement with the project and how did you come to the building?
I came to be involved with the Love Building because I was the executive director of Allied Media Projects. Allied Media Projects is a 20-something-year-old organization that cultivates media for liberation. And we had been experiencing a period of significant growth kind of between 2010 and 2017. And we'd been renting in a former furniture factory in Detroit's Cass Corridor that had also served as a community theater, and it was also a micro cinema at the time. And our neighborhood was experiencing a lot of development, a lot of gentrification, and Detroit as a whole was experiencing a lot of attention. It was fresh out of bankruptcy. We were having speculators eyeing the city from California or even as far as Japan, and property was getting scooped up with like million-dollar cash offers. And so as we were looking around and trying to think about where could be a new permanent home where we would have more stability, be at less risk of displacement ourselves, we found that it was really, really difficult environment to either find a long-term lease or purchase. And our realtor at the time, Emery Matthews, became aware that the building at 4731 Grand River, the owner was hoping to sell. So we were able to make an offer on the building prior to it being listed. And that was really the only reason that we were able to be successful in buying this new home. And very quickly realized, too, that it was a lot more space than what we needed. We were looking for about 2,000 to 3,000 square feet. Sandra, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that building is like 18,000 square feet, 22,000 square
feet. 25,000.
25.
That's a noticeable difference.
And so Allied Media Projects began talking with a lot of our kind of peer organizations in the social justice community of Detroit about the need that they also had for more permanent, centrally located, stable space that could also be accessible because so much of the built environment in Detroit is not accessible. And so that was kind of how the seed of the Love Building was planted.
And so what did the building look like, or what was kind of the state of the building when you first were walking through it and kind of getting a sense of deciding, is this a building you wanted to buy?
It's a beautiful building. Sandra can definitely describe more about sort of the architectural features and the era that it represents in Detroit's architectural story. But at the time when we purchased it, it had been used as kind of chopped up into a lot of small units for artist studios and small businesses. The previous owner and developer of it had kind of initiated the project at the height of the Richard Florida Cool Cities creative class idea that artists could catalyze other development in a place. Unfortunately, it wasn't deeply connected to the neighborhood itself, but it was a resource for artists. And over time, his investment in the building had declined and decreased to where when we bought it, it was about 50% occupied and in need of pretty serious repair. And we were initially imagining that we would build out the fourth floor for AMP's home and offices, but pretty quickly realized that the whole building needed to be structurally redesigned and renovated. And so we, at that time, had to make the really painful decision to ask the existing tenants that were left to move out. And it was painful because we had ourselves experienced displacement from the neighborhood where we had just been living. And we saw this as a pattern that was happening all over the city. And so at that point, in an attempt to sort of remediate and not just fuel these cycles of displacement, we committed to having the building be developed with a community benefits agreement at its heart that would ensure that it was a resource not only for the organizations who needed this new home, but for the surrounding neighborhood and community and the city as a whole.
So Sandra, share with us now about your involvement with the project. I know it came via RFP, so what made you want to respond to it?
Yeah, at the time that the RFP came out, I was a small firm owner who had done a number of co-working spaces in the city of Detroit. So it was kind of right up our wheelhouse to do this type of work, figure out how to set up offices for non-traditional ways of working. And it was only at the time just for the fourth floor of the building and to put in new office space for Allied Media. And as we went walking through the building and looking through the building, seeing a number of things that needed to be upgraded as far as electrical systems. Structurally, it's a beautiful building. It's all concrete. It's a very typical concrete roof slab. I mean, just like I said, the best bone building you could have. So it wasn't a question structurally what the building could do, but it was just electrically, the building wasn't up to par. And it did have a full building mechanical system to run the whole building. And then if we were to upgrade and do the fourth floor, we couldn't get the required power and mechanical needs that we needed for that as well. And there were electrical issues that were happening between the tenants by the time we had walked through after they had been in there for some time. So it became apparent that a master plan for the entire building would need to be done. We partnered with another nonprofit architectural firm, DJDS, and worked on that.
What does DJDS stand for?
Thank you. Yep. Design Adjusted Designing Spaces. And we went through a whole stakeholder engagement piece with Allied Media and community members and really start to think through that process. And then the project grew into the full 25,000 square foot renovation. Accessibility at the core of that driver for the project, putting in a new elevator and having the elevator become a centerpiece for design. All of that came from the master planning efforts and actually boots on the ground and walking through the building and figuring things out.
Yeah, and we'll put some photos of the elevator in the show notes as well. But can you talk a little bit about the accessibility piece of the elevator and what drove that to be a designed feature of it?
Wow. So one of the nonprofits that is part of Allied Media had a big push in that as well. So Detroit Disability Power is a nonprofit that advocates for accessibility in all walks of life. They're advocating for accessibility throughout our great city. It's a concrete warehouse building, but one of the things, this building had a loading dock that was in the rear of the building that made the first floor have two different floor levels, right? So that was the first point of conversation. Oh, we're going to have to create this ramp that goes from the back of the building to the front of the building to help navigate that change. And it just became a whole point of, why do we have to go to the back? Why, you know, having to have a back entrance? And Detroit Disability Power was the one that said it, and it was just powerful when she just asked the question why. So it became point, can we level out the first floor? I was like, yeah, we can. It's a cost to that, but we can, you know, that's something we could do. So that whole level, first floor level, was made into one level, and then accessibility to different floors became an issue. So the elevator became key to that as well. And it's at the front of the building, front and center, because of the point of why does someone with a disability have to go to the rear of the building to enter. And it really just hit home with everybody when we were in those stakeholder meetings saying that. Then it became a point with the elevator of having one elevator would put us at a point of one went down and you don't have redundancy, then it's still an accessibility issue. So it became two elevators. Actually, this two elevator thing actually happened during construction, but that's a whole conversation. But it was just remarkable to work with everybody around the table who were thinking about everyone's needs, the community's needs, disability, individuals' needs. Everything was always thought about and talked about in a roundtable situation where everybody was able to speak clearly and express the desires for the project.
Amazing. Kweku, why don't you tell us a little bit about your involvement with the project?
And if I may, actually, a couple of points I want to make, because the Trade Disability Power is such a powerful organization. And one of the things that Dessa and a number of her colleagues say often is when we design spaces, places, systems, et cetera, with disabled people in mind, then we end up actually creating solutions, spaces, and places that actually work ideally for everyone. And I think that this building is actually a beautiful testimony to that statement. And then I also just want to clarify that the building is currently home to 7 nonprofits, allied media projects, which steward this thing into being. A number of the organizations in the building have been incubated and spun out of allied media projects, but each of the organizations are distinct in themselves. And Detroit Disability Power, as well as Detroit Justice Center and a couple others, did not necessarily come from allied media projects, but the connective thread between all the organizations that called this place home is that each of them in their own kind of distinct way are setting new precedents towards creating, I think, more liberation, more joy, more inclusiveness for all peoples. And so, sorry, you had a question.
No, this is fantastic. So, Kweku, knowing that you are the executive director of the Love Building, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about your involvement with the building when you got to it, as well as how you're seeing the building being received by the community now that it's complete.
Yeah, so I got to join the building at probably one of the funner times when it was already done and open for a couple of months. And some of the big things that you have to do when you do such a large development, right? Because we're talking about, again, a 25,000 square foot building that was a $14 million development. And so I joined February 27, 2024. I think a lot of the really tough work was already done. And I got to come into a really beautiful situation that, like, you know, there was just so much intentionality, I think, baked into almost every square foot of the building, down to, we spoke about the accessibility pieces and the fact that this is currently the most accessible building in the city of Detroit. There was a lot of intentionality that went into design beyond accessibility, even down to the furniture. We had a lovely consultant by the name of Lydia Esparza, I think her last name is.
Esparza. Yeah, thank Lydia you. Esparza.
Yeah, who does a phenomenal thing in which she goes to a number of trade shows internationally. And you may know this, but like at the end of a number of these trade shows, sometimes there are furniture that is then just discarded. Well, she did this lovely thing where she would get them to donate that to her, and then she would donate or find beautiful placements for that beautiful furniture in places and spaces owned by nonprofits across, I think, the nation. And we were a beautiful benefactor of that work. And so anyway, I kind of got to come in and got to come into this beautiful situation where there, again, are these 7 nonprofits doing great work individually, distinctively, but then also increasing collectively just by sharing a home and sharing this space. And the Love Building, we are ourselves also a nonprofit. And our vantage point, other than being the beautiful home to those 7 nonprofits, we're increasingly trying to have this space be a community asset. And the way we are increasingly getting clever about doing that is by allowing the community at large to leverage the asset. There's some direct things that we do to support that, but I'll share like one thing that we are experimenting with now. There's a number of people in Detroit that just have so much creativity, resourcefulness, ingenuity. There's so much beauty inside of a lot of people in Detroit. And unfortunately, there are far too many Detroiters that don't have as much external resources that map all the beauty they have inside of them. So we are increasingly trying to, like, you know, create an outlet for a lot of that beauty that's inside of them to come outside of them. And so should anyone or any organization be throwing an event, as far as it's aligned with our 7 values, which you can find on our website, or fits within the buckets of health, wealth, and love, and as far as it's free and open to the public, then we will actually allow them to use our space free of charge. And at the end of that, we are surveying attendees to see, like, hey, you know, how did this resonate? You know, how did this land with you? Is this something that shouldn't just been a one-off, or is this something that should have some recurring cadence? And if we find that there should be a recurring cadence, then we're trying to get really smart about how we potentially bring some resources or some support to allow that to actually happen. So,
yeah. And so then did some of these conversations come out during the development of the community benefits package, or is this something that's come out as the building has been open? And so I'd love to delve more into the community benefits package and kind of what's in there and how it's been working.
Yeah, I can say a little bit, and then Kweku definitely can say more about how it's all working now. I want to say that the CBA had kind of multiple layers. As a lot of people are probably familiar, a CBA in a traditional development context oftentimes gets really limited to job creation, remediating the environmental harms related to a development project, and yeah, local hiring quotas, things like that. But we wanted ours to really be focused on how can the nonprofits in this building tailor the offerings that they already have to the specific needs of this neighborhood. And on another level, like how can we ensure that the building is welcoming, the building is providing programs that meet community needs. And then there was a whole addendum to the CBA that focused really specifically on disability justice and accessibility, because as Kwaku and Sandra have both mentioned, that was such a core part of the identity and of the building from the very beginning, and the way in which we were really trying to model a new level of possibility when it comes to access in Detroit specifically. And I guess the last thing I'll say is that the process was powerful because it started actually in the midst of the pandemic. Like, we assembled an advisory board of residents from around the Core City neighborhood in literally like April of 2020. And the whole first year of those meetings where we were talking to folks, introducing the project to the neighborhood, that was all over Zoom. And we had our beloved caterer, like food justice worker named Mama Neza Bendele, who made meals for all of the advisory board members. And we had them delivered to the people's homes so they were able to eat over these meetings. And I also want to shout out Sidewalk Detroit, which was the contractor that Allied Media Projects actually worked really closely with in facilitating this whole process. And then from there, we had this initial draft of what the CBA was. That took a whole year to get to. But then we did a second year of kind of further refinement and like pulling out these different pieces, whether it was the disability justice part or another component, which was we called the Art and Archive Advisory Board. And so they were really focused on the preservation and the honoring of the legacy of the building as an arts hub. There was a lot of incredible artwork on the building and the neighboring structures, like murals that were really significant, that were honoring lives lost to police violence and racist violence. And so that advisory body kind of worked specifically to recreate and redesign a new mural that would live on the whole, what is that, northwest facade of the building that says it's the ancestral love mural. It says ancestral love moving us forward. Yeah. And so it was a whole process of working with longtime residents of Core City to kind of determine who should be featured there, as well as tenants of the building. What are the local activists and unsung heroes of Detroit that we wanted to really memorialize coming out of the pandemic, especially through the artwork in the building?
We did the community benefits agreement and we're very fortunate. We gave ourselves a 5-year time frame to complete a number of the things that came out of the desires of the community at large. We are about year and a half in, it's about 75-80% done with a number of the things that were listed. And given that, we kind of serve three circles of community, if you would. So one is our tenant partners and their constituents. The second is area residents of Core City neighborhood. And then the third is kind of like the social justice and creative community as a whole. And so as we are serving those communities, we're kind of becoming a space for Detroit as a whole. So now we have wide swaths from all over the city coming to this space, which is a beautiful thing. So just getting smarter about how we create an outlet or a conduit for them to continue to surface things that they might want to see us attempt to do. Not that we'd be able to do everything. We can't be everything to everyone. There's so much more we can do, especially when we are informed by the community at large. So to the extent that this is a calling card to kind of just share, like, hey, you could hit us up, info@thelovebuilding.org. to just let us know, like, hey, really love what you guys are doing here. Are you guys open to potentially considering this, or have you thought about this? And we're open to that type of feedback.
Let's take a quick break so you can learn more about the sponsor of this limited series, Quinn Evans. Quinn Evans is a design firm committed to stewardship and the transformation of places that serve and inspire communities. As the proud recipient of the American Institute of Architects 2024 Architecture Firm Award, Quinn Evans is driven by the belief in the power of design to sustain, renew, and reimagine the built environment. Through partnerships with public institutions, nonprofits, and private organizations, Quinn Evans delivers thoughtful design that connects people and leaves a lasting impact. Discover more at quinnevins.com. That's www.quinnevans.com. And now back to the show.
One other thing I'm just realizing, I think we should also name because it's so important, is just that this project would not have been possible without certain people who are trying to attempt a more radical version of philanthropy. Because as Kwaku mentioned, this is a $14 million project. And at the end, we're emerging from it more or less debt-free, which is a miracle. In particular, like Mackenzie Scott yield giving, you know, which she basically, you know, got a payout from her divorce settlement with Jeff Bezos and was like, I'm going to give the majority of this away in a no strings attached, unsolicited fashion. And it was that really unconventional approach to philanthropy that enabled the elevator, the second elevator decision that we made halfway through. Also, the Katali Foundation in California, which is a spend down foundation led by Numaka Agbo, who's a visionary who has articulated this framework of restorative economics. They're in the business of making 0% interest, very significant loans, capital grants, essentially enable these kinds of transformative restorative economics projects. And so I think if the world wants more versions of the love building, the way that funders approach giving and being more bold, more radical, and like just giving more money away to projects that have visions and teams that are ready to do big projects like this. And in that sort of like patient iterative process that I described, it also allows for that to be more possible.
Were there other types of funding sources within the equity stack?
So many. So New Markets Tax Credits made a very late our decision to pursue that, like when the building was 90% done, which was a challenge, many, many thousands of receipts that had to be compiled, a construction loan from Michigan First Credit Union, a program-related investment from the Tides Network, and then a couple million dollars of just general operating grants that Allied Media Projects had. So it was interesting in the sense that, like, how do you fundraise? Like, Allied Media Projects did do the bulk of the capital raising, and that was a decision made early on because at that time, of all the tenant partners, Allied Media Projects was the only one that was old enough to be able to really get financing. So, you know, you have to have a track record of however many years and certified audits in order to actually get a loan. And so that preliminary loan that allowed for the acquisition and that first phase of renovation was actually from IFF. Can't forget to mention them, you know, one of the bigger CDFIs, and they also served as owners reps throughout the project. Anyways, but in light of that, you know, the way that our tenants were able to really still support the fundraising efforts was that at the very beginning, they all signed 10-year leases at market rate. And so that allowed us to say to the funders, this building is fully occupied and we have 10-year leases and they're all going to pay market rate, basically. So the tenant partners are able to, kind of invest in the financial picture that way rather than them kind of pursuing capital grants in addition to Allied Media Projects. And it made the whole process a lot cleaner. I just want to mention Kyle Rollins, who was so instrumental in this whole process too. And so like having a team with varied expertise, and Kyle basically was the kind of facilitator of a lot of the capital stack building. And,
gotcha.
And he comes from Designing Justice, Designing Spaces, but is now independent and was an incredible resource.
And then how has it been received by the community now that it is operational?
Yeah, so it's been a delight. I think because of the organizations that are in the building, there is a very diverse group of folks that are coming into the space. They love the space because it's a beautiful space. And it was very, I think, intentionally designed to be very welcoming, very inclusive, very warm. So the beautiful thing that I think increasingly is happening is that we have folks as young as, I want to say, like 6, 7 to as old as in the late 70s, maybe even early 80s that have come into the space. And they are increasingly offering things that we might do. They see the potential. I think we've thrown several events to bring the community in, and they love us so much. They're like, oh, what about this? Let's do a game night here and all that. So it was a really beautiful energy. I think that there is a particular thing that people get when they come into this building that is very hard to articulate through words. It's one of those things you kind of come in and kind of experience it. And then you're like, oh, wow. Okay. We've had, I mean, again, a diversity of whether it be area residents to community leaders to high net worth individuals or philanthropic leaders, et cetera, et cetera. And the beautiful thing that I think we've been increasingly able to do is to have folks come in, take off whatever title they may have, whatever mask they have, and feel very comfortable and be themselves, and increasingly creating community across several different communities that often don't interweave with each other as much as we'd perhaps like to see. But we're increasingly seeing it in the building. And I think it's coming at a perfect time where we really need to all be coming together as much as possible.
Yeah, I love that the building is the vessel for interaction and for really helping people feel safe to seek more liberation and joy and love. And Sandra, knowing that that is what's happening to the building, and knowing that that was, I'm sure, baked into the design intent, what are some of the things from an architecture side that the team was intentional about to make sure that the building would be able to be a vessel for all these interactions?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of things happen with conversations between the nonprofits that are housed in the building. And we literally, especially in the early master planning phase, really talk through, like, what does that community space on the first level look like? How do we want to use it? How does it break out and be able to flow into other areas? Just learning from nonprofits. I mean, our first stakeholder with the tenants and everything engagement was in person in the building, which was really cool, right? It was raw space. We were on the first floor. Mama Neza catered. So when Jeanette said that, I was like, yeah, food is good. Mama Neza, okay. Really good. All of those conversations that we had around the table, around food, we actually had a round table, almost like a sitting round circle where everybody shared out what they wanted that space to feel like. All of those things are present today in the project. Even like from how do I use my spaces on an upper level, and then what spaces are available to me, amenities are available to me on the first level. Everybody had a say in that. And I think this is just reaping the rewards of them seeing exactly what we discussed together in this first intimate setting. It actually was planned that way and built that way. And it's showing in the community that's being built there.
One thing I'll add about that design process, I don't know if you remember this, Sandra, but initially that whole front area, which is now the like gorgeous lobby where all this flow happens, we were going to chop it up into additional tenant spaces, like the whole front. And the lobby was actually maybe a quarter of that. And it was Shanita from your team who also, like, so much love to Shanita. She was like, one of the goals of this is like people intersecting and having these kind of spontaneous encounters and like critical connections in the building. Like, you might want to just open up this whole front area. And we were like, right, that's not going to happen if everyone's just crowded into a tiny space. And so it was hard because I think initially we were imagining there was going to be like an acupuncture tenant in that front space. But we were like, in order to like have the physical space really be this vessel for interconnectivity, we need to do that. So yeah. That was
very true. And that front space too had a mezzanine level that made the ceiling low. So we had to not only level the first floor, we also had to remove that. It was a mechanical mezzanine that had some mechanical units there. So that full height and giving that space to full height, being able to open up those windows in the front that are pretty gorgeous and historic in themselves.
And saving those historic transoms. Yeah. That was also so key. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was one part of it. It was a lot of cultural preservation that happened during this project. It was the, like I said, saving the mullions, the existing wood mullions that were part of the window system. We put in new storefront windows, but we brought back that mullion system and it became an insert into the top arch glass that was originally there. Like when Jeanette was talking about the murals, we even had our artistic preservationists come out and look at some of the murals, and there was photo documentation done of all the murals before the new mural was created on the northwest side, like Jeanette was talking about. It's just so many little careful things that were done throughout the process. And we were like, okay, what part of the address can we save? Can, you know, are we going to keep this one sign that's outside? It's just different things. It was like, oh, the vault door. Was a big one. That was in that whole front lobby area too. And when we eliminated the mezzanine, the vault door ended up being preserved and used in the event space. So it was just a lot of key things. Like, how can we keep the original character of the building and also have it show in the new build out?
One thing that too, like when you mentioned the artists, that was healing for me because it was such a difficult time. Like when we were having these realizations about like how drastically the whole space would have to be transformed and like existing tenants having to leave. But it was really through the recreation of that mural on the northwest facade that so many different artists who had long time histories with the building were coming back into the process. So like Adino Valdez Jr., whose parents owned the Manila Bay Cafe, that was this beloved open mic night and poetry cafe in the space, he ended up painting the whole frame of that mural. And then we commissioned an original piece by him that incorporates a haiku that was written by Rosemary Wilson, who used to be the host of that poetry night, into, and that is now featured in the main community event space. And then just being able to like bring artists back into the building who had their studios there at one point or another, because so many Detroit artists did. And then for them to be able to see it and feel love and that it's been transformed in a worthy way, which is just, it's hard to say that for a lot of these historic structures in Detroit, unfortunately, that too often when an old building is saved and renovated, like it's a total erasure and there isn't that spirit, that nothing of that spirit remains. And I think we were able to, with the Love Building, through all those steps that Sandra was mentioning, make a space that people who have memories of it can be in it and still feel that connection.
I love that. Yes. And that feels like such the goal and the impetus for any of the adaptive reuse projects that we're doing. Like, how do we still honor the past while doing something for the present and the future? And so I'm so thrilled to hear that it's being received by people who had past lives with the building mm-hmm. in a way that they see themselves in it and they still feel respected and loved. Oh, that gives me chills. And so why don't we pivot? And I would love to hear from each of you one lesson learned on the project.
Don't do a project in a pandemic, but other than that.
Yeah, don't let there be a pandemic. I mean, I guess something that I find myself often saying is that, so like from my background being more so in community organizing, in sort of like facilitative participatory processes, right? There's like such a value of iteration where you're not going in a straight line. You're not like, oh, we're going to start at point A, we're going to do these steps, and we're going to reach point B. It's like we're testing something, we're listening, we're learning, we're then offering it back and then getting more feedback and changing it again. And what I learned is that that process, while it is possible in the world of real estate development, it is so expensive because, like Sandra mentioned, halfway through your process, you will learn that the best practice of accessibility is elevator redundancy. And that might cost you another $1.5 million to add a second elevator in its, you know, attached to the tower of your new elevator that's being constructed. And so like holding values, like if you are a values-based organization, there's like, this is our value and we're going to hold it even if it is going to make things take longer and cost more, but it's worth it in the end. That can be really hard. And I wish that real estate development and capitalism was not set up to be so adversarial to authentic, iterative, deep listening in community engagement.
Yeah, the whole linear timeline for construction is definitely not friendly to that type of ethos and what the organization had behind it. So yeah, we were in the middle of construction and we were actually on a virtual OAC call, which is a, you know, owners and contractor and architects call. And Jeanette was like, yeah, we've raised funds and we want to add a second elevator tower. And we're like, did she just say she want to add a second elevator tower? I mean, the whole call was just paused. Like, wait a minute, what? Okay. You really want to do this? Yeah, this, we think this is important. It's important for redundancy. It's important for our tenants. And we were like, whoa, everybody's like, I don't think we've ever done this before, but okay. You know, it's like, okay, we'll look at a way to, and we ended up creating like two separate lobbies. Like, so it was a lobby area that the employees could use and became a backbone to each of their use. And then there's a main elevator lobby when you come into the building that the public and the front desk can control and look at. So it ended up working out, but it's like, that's not originally what we had planned. So it led to so much more. I mean, I even learned about so much more about all the nonprofits at that time. Cause like when we put the second elevator in, we also added these wellness spaces or retreat rooms that are also in that addition. And they were like, it's important for us to have self-care doing this type of work. And I can actually say, like, coming through architecture, they feel like they just pushed you, right? You don't, like, self-care was like a back burner. I was just like, I learned so much during this project. I was like, yeah, I need to practice some self-care. I need to, yeah. So I learned a lot from the nonprofit world and taking care of yourself as you're doing the work, as you're doing the hard thing. So all of that ended up getting baked in, even with the change during construction. It's just, it still was all baked in with their flavor and their love.
I love everything they both said for many reasons. I think the beautiful thing that I've learned throughout this whole being engaged in this project is that it's twofold. On one hand, I think that you can bake in as much intentionality on the front end as you could attempt to do. And even still, the reality of the situation as it's unfolding will present things that you couldn't have thought to consider, right? So I think the beautiful thing about this project is that due to the level of intentionality they had, I think there's a lot of happy accidents. I think we've heard a number of those. And I think the beauty is that we've allowed ourselves space and grace to not just be reactive, but to actually be adaptive and flexible to the things that are coming. And how important that is, I want to echo Jenny's statement that it isn't common that spaces or places allow for that. I'm so thankful that this is a space that did do that. And I think it is perhaps setting a really shining example of the benefit of that. And I think that as more and more people are becoming aware of the project and how we've created this responsive, really, again, increasingly community asset, I think that there are more and more people that are moving or kind of leaning or bending in this direction, which is a beautiful thing, I think, for everyone.
It is amazing. I guess a full circle moment. I even had a chance to host an event in the Love Building last September. It was amazing to be there, and it was an amazing event. So it was one of the 14 cities that hosted the Black Women in Architecture brunch. We had a room full of at least maybe 40 people that were live simulated to the other cities and celebrating the Black Women in Architecture brunch that has been going on, I think, now for about 10 years. And it was amazing to be in that space that I worked on for so long and just to enjoy it.
Next week, on the final episode of the Building Reuse is Climate Action Limited series, sponsored by Quinn Evans, we'll head to Cambridge, Maryland, to learn more about the Packing House. Tune in to learn how this long vacant building was able to be reused into an economic driver to revitalize an industry.
The magical part of that building is the two-story atrium space, and it is the center. You walk into that space, you've got clerestory on both sides. So the magic is there. It pulls together the whole building with a core that can be seen from all sides of the building.
Hey, designers and curious minds. Ever wondered about the stories hiding within your building's walls? I'm Carrie Seaburn, structural engineer and host of Unstruct, the podcast that decodes and simplifies major concepts of structural design. Behind the math and physics, structural engineering simply predicts building behavior. Join me as we simplify the complex, making structural design accessible to everyone.
Nowadays, instead of measuring it via cost, we're saying, well, what about carbon, you know? We've got two levers now that we can, if an architect has an inefficient design, we can hit them with two levers, if you like.
The official casualty figure is 55,000. Everybody I talked to told me that the actual figure is at least three times as much. And I believe that. I mean, seeing what I saw, Turkish codes are good, and they have been improving, but compliance was completely lacking.
Fluent in steel, concrete, masonry, and timber design, I'll bring you leading engineers to dissect the tales behind their building structure. Whether you're an architect, contractor, engineer, or just love a good story, this podcast is for you.
Yeah, beam penetrations. That's a fun topic on this project.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Unstruct. From within your walls, hear the story behind how your building stands today.